Announcements. Let me welcome you on behalf of the Library of JTS to another in our ongoing series of book talks. As those of you who have been here and participate regularly know, really a wonderful way to be exposed to important new books by our faculty, by friends, and by others. And as you know, tonight's book is by Rabbi Benjamin Siegel, Qohelet's Pursuit of Truth. This is a book that includes both translation and commentary, essays and questions. I asked Benji, before we began, to whom is this addressed? And as you'll see when you read it, the answer is anybody, but it's particularly good as a book for education and self-education. It's a way of devoting yourself to a book, that is to say, the book of Qohelet, Ecclesiastes, which deserves devotion, being one of the most brilliant pieces of our entire canon. And it's a book that perplexes and challenges, so we need teachers to help us through it. And in this book, Rabbi Siegel really represents himself as a master teacher. And so I'm quite sure that after the presentation, you will see the value of engaging it through his insights. I'll only say briefly before you begin that, as you can see, volumes will be for sale following. And the author, I'm sure, would be very pleased to sign your copy. Rabbi Siegel, please.
I think I'll try that.
You want to do it up here? Okay, good.
I don't know.
Whatever makes you comfortable.
If I feel uncomfortable here, I'll move over. Work? Oh, we'll try. We'll try. Thank you. Thank you, Kol HaKavod. Kol HaKavod for many things I asked and Professor Kramer actually created this whole idea. It's incredible. Thank you, Kol HaKavod. It's a wonderful thing. Thank the hosts. Thank the sponsors. I have a long history of admiration and involvement, support for the seminary. This is a bit awkward tonight. A few reasons. Well, the first is probably, you all know the phrase, 3-day-a-year Jews. I'm a 3-tie-day-a-year person. And now the seminary has twice in the past month forced me to put on a tie, not on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. So that's the first awkwardness. The second one is somebody has to have a lot of chutzpah to title something a new reading of Ecclesiastes, when Ecclesiastes is the guy who originated the phrase, there's nothing new under the sun. Well, here goes. I do believe it's a new reading. My first reading of Ecclesiastes goes back to years when we were studying together with great master of Ecclesiastes and teacher, Dr. Gordas. We studied here. Dr. Gordas was great. He encouraged me. I disagreed with him about lots of things, but he was a teacher who knew how to encourage you, even if he knew you disagreed with him. It was unbelievable. My first commentary was on Song of Songs, where I really disagreed with Dr. Gordas's interpretation. But he had so encouraged me, after fighting with him for 4 months in class, to continue my work on the book, that he was the first person I sent a manuscript to. I said, I know you don't agree, but wow. Hey, you have good night classes? That's impressive. That's impressive. What are they studying? They're not coming here. All right. Let me start with two quotes. You probably don't need hype for Ecclesiastes. I will use Ecclesiastes for the book. Okay? I'll try to remember. If I make a mistake, you'll correct me. And Qohelet for the person who speaks most of the lines, practically all the lines in the middle. Okay? That will help us as we go along. So when I'll use the English word, which was an attempt to translate Qohelet once upon a time, but that's how we'll use them. Ecclesiastes, the book, Qohelet's going to be the the character. Thomas Wolfe, who at the time was considered perhaps one of the greatest writers of his time, he lost a little bit of his patina later, spoke of Kohelet as follows: the greatest single piece of literature I have known. Not a small compliment. And now, skipping 100 years, I quote from Chaim Shapiro. He's a sort of a, I don't know if you can be a Renaissance man in the 21st century, but he seems to know everything, writes books on all sorts of things in Israel. And I translate from his work on Ecclesiastes. All the clearly unsystematic existential philosophies, such as Nietzsche, Dostoevsky, Kierkegaard, Camus, Tolstoy, are, as far as I'm concerned, an ongoing series of footnotes to the thought of Ecclesiastes. That is high praise. That's high praise. We can argue a little bit with that. Elliot Dorf and I did once for a while. But this is a book. And I'm not talking about my commentary. I'm talking about Ecclesiastes right now. It was so controversial, as you, I'm sure most of you know, and if you don't, it's okay too, that there was debate about it early in the rabbinic period, and in the later rabbinic period, when we were heading towards exile, there it was included in the debate of essentially censorship. Let's get rid of it. Let's deep six it. Let's get rid of this book in its time. Its depth won out. It was not so censored. Footnote, I digress. We're not sure the rabbis ever had the power to do this censorship. I think they thought they did. Very interesting. Rabbis, when they talk among themselves, anyway. but they discussed it, at any rate, for reasons that are obvious. He's down on a lot of things. One can perhaps try to run away from Ecclesiastes if you've read it, but one cannot hide. With every facile answer that we give to life's hardest questions, the book reappears once again to challenge and reject our simplistic flights of fantasy. One and almost all are haunted by this magnificent work. Let's get on the same page. By the way, you can make a comment at any point. I have to finish on time, and I promise I will. And I won't answer a question if it takes me far afield or something like that. Anyway. The book. This is a book that was written approximately in the year 250 BCE. That's almost a wall-to-wall agreement among scholars. One disagreed, but he's been refuted too. It is not, as we grew up, many of us thinking or were told, that Solomon wrote the book of Ecclesiastes. He could not have written it in its form. Language changes. You know that it's hard to read Shakespeare. It's impossible to read Chaucer. And over 800 years, language changes. The language of Ecclesiastes is approximately the year 250 BCE. It is reacted to in a book at the beginning of the 2nd century BCE, Ecclesiasticus, so obviously is already in circulation before that. It does not have any Greek in it, approximately 250 BCE. In terms of your time, and you don't have to be an expert in world literature, but it gives you something, right? There's a flowering Greek literature. It is the age of several writers who were later grouped as Epicureans or as Stoics. That causes a lot of controversy. Did one know the other? Who knew who? Who's quoting from who? That's possibly the time. It was an age also, and I shall repeat this at the end, in the Bible of our greatest literature, as we use the term literature. Genesis is great, so is the Talmud great. But in terms of the way we use literature, novels, playing with form and intricate double meanings, the early Second Temple period is unbelievable. I guess I should throw in this, just, it's not the subject of my talk tonight. I was at one point going to do a 20 or 30 page excursus in this thing on the theories or the approaches to the parallels between Greek and literature and Ecclesiastes. Having read God knows how many books on that, the conclusion again is almost uniform. And so I decided in the book and tonight I'm going to just do the same thing. There's no one who can attribute Ecclesiastes to any Greek school. No one says this is exactly a quote. It doesn't quite work that way. The questions are in the air. The thinking is in the air. The reliance on your own intellect to solve things is in the air. But they're not. It's not part of a Greek school. And at least to date, no one really claims that. There's one wonderful difference. I really digress, but there's this tremendous difference. I was going to make a big point of this at one point. The Greeks were looking for truth. Truth shall set us free. Yeah? And having found it, whatever your philosophy is, the result was they were happy. Kohelet is destroyed by what he learns and doesn't learn. He is just taken apart. Bickerman already noted this in his book on Kohelet. He said, it's fine if you start with the pagan beliefs, but if you were looking for the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and you come up with finding no empirical proof for the truths of your tradition, that is a horrible crisis. He's not happy. He's in pain. And that's so different than any of the Greek philosophies. In that way, in no way is he a member of the Greek schools. Okay. A few more words on Ecclesiastes. I'll speak a few things about Ecclesiastes just to get you in the mood, and then I'll talk about the commentary, which is different and is supposed to be the new part. How does this start? Remember how the book starts. Is this wonderful? Yeah, what the heck. This wonderful poem, which I'm reading, not quite where it exists. You know, I'm skipping up over it. First, a narrator comes in. The book is structured as a narrator who introduces the words, all of Kohelet's words, different speeches, and then a narrator, presumably the same one. It is the same one, he says, who comes back and concludes. It's not a strange form. We have it in antiquity. You all know one book like that. You just don't think about it, and that's Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy is announced. These are the words of Moses, three speeches by Moses, and then at the end, the narrator comes back and narrates his death. There are about eight other books in antiquity that we have from other cultures that work that way. It's not an absurd model. So, when Ecclesiastes starts, here's... I'm starting at verse 4. You'll understand why in a minute. A generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever the same. And the sun rises and the sun sets and hastens to the place whereat it rises. Going south, going north, turning, turning goes the wind. And upon its turnings the wind comes back. All the rivers go to the sea, but the sea is never full. To the place where the rivers go, there they continue to go. Everything is complete. It's cycling. It's under. It may be swirling, but it comes back. Everything is same. It's very solid. Remember, we started another book that way. It's called the Torah. We started with creation. Similar words. Wind, the sun, the wind, the waters. There, for a minute, if you'll think about what happens in Bereishit, that solidity and order, and it was good, the 7 days, everything was very good, sets the tone for, and man is the pinnacle of creation, sets the tone for what comes after. It sets an ideal. This could have done that, except for what happens to this poem when it's framed, when Kohelet finally writes or his works are edited. This is something he says early. When the book is first published, which is evidently after his death by this narrator, before this little poem comes the verse, what advantage can man gain through all the spoils for which he toils under the sun? What's the meaning of all this cyclical stuff? You can't do anything about anything. Right? And then afterwards, the English is my own, and if you want to challenge it, all things after these four cycles. All things plod on. No man can portray, no eye can totally see, no ear can fully hear. What was is what will be, and what was done is what will be done, and there is nothing new under the sun. The same
solid creation becomes a source of just depression. Nothing changes. You can't do anything about anything. The narrator summarizes that at the very beginning by saying, Havel Havelim, often translated since King James, vanity of vanities, best, I believe, vapor of vapors, Hevel. It's nothing. It's a wind. It's what you can't grasp and can't hold on to. It has no solidity in time or space. Vapor of vapors, that's what Kohelet is, and then he goes into the speech. The opening section of Kohelet goes on like that. After this, he writes a fiction within a fiction. The whole thing is a fiction. He says, now let me tell you who I am. I was once a king. I was the richest of kings, the most powerful of kings, could do anything I want. I got wiser than anybody, more wise, more money, more slaves, more this, more that than that. I tried this. You know, not there, nothing happened. This didn't answer. Was not the truth. This was not the truth. Even joy at this point he tries and say, joy was not the truth. Nothing is the truth. I tried. And then he has another poem, which you know even better. To everything there is a season and a time for every purpose under heaven, which is the way the song sings it. I translate it a little bit. King James's. And again, at the second poem in this opening section, how does he summarize after the second poem? It's almost verbatim. Here it is. What advantage does one achieve through all this toil? The problem with most interpretations of Kohelet is they never got beyond there. And what they now tell you is how Kohelet repeats himself, how Kohelet contradicts himself, how Kohelet runs this on and on and on and on. But that's not what Kohelet is about. And what I plan to do in presenting the essence or the main points of this commentary is show you that that's not at all what happens. That's the first chapter. There are three units within the structure of Kohelet, and it is not the first unit that tells us all about Kohelet. That's where it started. The book ends very far from the beginning. Second unit, which is the big middle unit, are six chapters, each of which ends, very clearly structured, be happy. Each of them begins with the word see, ra'ah, experience. Very clear physical structure. And those six units are observing other people. The first unit, he's talking about himself and what I tried. Second unit, it's sort of a life story, and there's cyclical things because it's a story. What's important to him comes back. What I see in the world. And the final unit, death. The first unit ends with taking it back and saying, being little joy. In the second unit, the six sub-units all end with joy. And the last unit begins with joy. Smach Bachur. It is a very clear structure. There's growth. When you see structure, you see change. You say, well, if there's change, then maybe the beginning is not like the end. So allow me first then, at some length, because this will be perhaps the best way to illustrate what goes on, to show you what happens to the character of Kohelet as he talks his way through the book. Okay? And I'll do it through points which I think all of you know. We either authors say he contradicts himself or don't notice, but here. Very beginning, toward the beginning of the book, Kohelet says, I apologize for using the English. It's easier, it's quicker, okay? If anyone knows the Hebrew and wants to challenge, please, I'll be happy. Who knows if a man's spirit rises up while an animal's spirit sinks down to the earth? A very clear rejection of a belief that's evidently new in his time, that there might be an afterlife, It's the end of the biblical period. Afterlife is starting to pop up in here and there. So, we don't know that. Nobody knows that, right? Do you remember the last verse, the last thing that Kohelet says? Not the book, but Kohelet. At the end of the poem of death. And the spirit returns to God who gave it. What happened? Did he lose his courage? Did he change his mind? Did he grow smart? Did he grow weak? But there certainly seems, that's the beginning and end. That should tell you something, but it goes on and on. Here. You know this. Everybody knows these things. I find women more bitter than death. I looked for one woman. I'm paraphrasing. I looked for one woman in 1,000. I couldn't find one. Pretty nasty, right? And three chapters later, he says, so find life and love with the woman that you love all the days of your hevel life. What happened? Excuse my colloquial. What happened? All right, going on. We can say the similar thing about life. All right? Kohelet 4:2. I commend the dead more than the living. Kohelet, about stillbirth, better than some. If a man's appetite is not sated, then I say that the stillbirth is better off than he. It's pretty negative, right? And this is the guy who goes on to say, better a live dog than a dead lion. I think you're getting a tone here. There's change. There's development. There's a character who is saying new things. Going on. First person speech. Bickerman, many people have noted for a long time that more than any book in the Bible, the person uses, Kohelet says, I. Not only does he say I, he says I, ani ra'iti. Not ra'iti, ani, I saw. It means I saw. I translate that way all the time when I was there. Ani amarti, ani, I said. The emphasis on I is extreme. It befits this period in Greek thought as well. All right? And it goes throughout the book until chapter 10, and I disappears. Disappears. There's no more I at the end of the book of Kohelet. It's just gone. And while that's happening, let's take two other things that are going the other way. There are very few metaphors in the first half of Kohelet, with the outstanding exception of hevel, breath, which is a very potent metaphor, a vapor. As the book proceeds, metaphors start to creep in more and more, and by the time you get to the end and the poem of death, you have a cascade of metaphors such as you find nowhere else in the Bible. It is the most powerful metaphoric section that we have in the entire Bible. What happened from zero? Or advice. In the beginning, he doesn't give advice. And then he starts in chapter 4 by sort of vague advice. Better do this than to do that. And then he goes on to a little bit more. One should. Kedai or something. And then finally, in the end, by telling people, do it, smach bachur, a command form. All right? So advice has moved up, metaphors have moved up, I has disappears, other words disappear. Ru'ut ruach, which with Rashi, I translate as anguish, is a very powerful central word in Kohelet until chapter 6. And then it disappears. It disappears from the book. I talked about the three units. Even joy. Joy goes from it's not worth it to accept it, take it when it happens, it's a gift from God, And at the end, seek it. Smach bachur. Make it.
Huge, huge climb up the hill. Let me do one more. I don't know how many I could do. These are the ones I collected.
sympathy, empathy. Certain words just become more human. Breath is a description of things and the world for the first half of the book of Kohelet. As it moves along, it becomes a description of life. My days of vapor, your days of vapor, his days of vapor. The sun goes through a similar kind of thing. The sun is one of those elements that never changes. It goes up, it sets, it comes back, it's in it. It gets, it divides the world above and below. God's up there, we don't know what's going on. So it starts to warm you, and by the last reference to the sun is part of the death poem, until the sun fades. Now, of course, the sun doesn't fade. Your eyes fade. You don't see the sun. It becomes a personal sun. What's happening?
I'm not sure what's happening. I can tell you if you want. I'm going to do that. I can read you what I think is happening. I put it in here. But when I put it in here, I said the following, and this is more important. I don't want to tell the reader what's happening in terms of why he did it. That's not the point. What I am telling the reader as an interpreter is that there's change. Now, whether you consider this a compliment to Kohelet because he got smarter with age, or whether you consider this to be a loss of courage in Kohelet, like no atheists in foxholes, when you're reaching the end, you can't hold your ground anymore, and you say, okay, it's all true, because he's clearly becoming more traditional. But it's more than that. He's become a teacher. He drops the I. He adopts metaphor. he gives advice. The observer is becoming a teacher. It's not just confronting and philosophy. The person is a different person. All of that says two things. One, which I've already hinted, I'll come back to it, is the book is about questions, not answers. All these things lead to what's going on and why and how do I feel about it. Second, more to the point, it's a book that has change and that grows. It is, in fact, in a vague kind of way, a novella or a long short story. You're following a character who's introduced, who introduces himself very dramatically as false story within a story, who clearly is moving as he's going along. Now, you might say, it's the aging process. You might say, no, it's the observation process. You're all stuck up in yourself in the beginning. You're looking at other people, and that creates a whole new dynamic, which brings you to a new person. In any case, for the reader, you're engaging a dynamic that makes you confront the person. Do it without this. Anybody saying to anybody else walking down the elevator or walking out the thing says, you know, ultimately the only questions in life is really to be or not to be. That's the only thing to do. All right, that's an interesting piece of conversation. It comes in, it comes out. When you read Hamlet and you get to be or not to be, and it's Hamlet who is saying it, every inch of your soul, every fiber of your being is involved in the question that he's asking. And you don't know. You know, Hamlet altogether, you do not know. Is this a conniver or is this a madman? You'll never know. That's literature, and that's what Kohelet is. It's literature. You confront the claims through the person, and that makes you think, and that makes you judge, and that's what the book wants you to do. Next proof. All right, next proof. There's a fellow named Sailor. Sailor. S-A-Y-L-E-R, I believe this is how I pronounce it. He made his doctoral thesis into a book. You can always tell a book that's been a doctoral thesis. No matter what you do, you can always tell. Right? So he's wrote his book about the use of I in Kohelet. And
he comes to the following conclusion. Kohelet made a bad tactical and strategic choice, because when you use I, it's less convincing than when you use third person. If I tell you the world is getting drier, that it is 80% covered by water, and it is more salty than it was 20 years ago, that's interesting. You'll confront that. The minute I say the same sentences and say, I think the world is getting drier, I think it's about 80%, and it seems to me that the water is saltier, you immediately doubt it. And you look at me and wonder who I am and what expertise I have. The use of I is a less convincing tactic than third-person statements, right? So Saylor concludes, Kohelet made a mistake. I can only think very fondly of my greatest teacher ever, Professor Moshe Greenberg Zal. Near the end of his life, he was asked, what's your approach to studying Bible? And his answer was, I always assumed that the author was at least as intelligent as I am. The mistake that Saylor made. Saylor was supposed to say, why did he use I? Not that he made a mistake by using I, right? And when you start to think about it, you say, what? You mean somebody wanted the arguments to be weaker? Yes! If you're writing a philosophy, no. If you're writing a novella, if you want people to confront the claim, if you want people to think, yes. This is material that you're to confront, and you're to confront Kohelet's claim through the character of Kohelet, through sympathy, through disgust, through... I have friends who differ very much with me on in the end of how they feel about Kohelet, but we're confronting him from reading and understanding a character and bringing ourselves to the text. This is the book of Kohelet, the most... Oh, I hate to use this phrase. It's really wrong. I'll use it anyway, just to shock you. The most postmodern book that we have in our tradition, almost to modernity. It's asking the reader to make the real decisions. Right? Now, it's not quite postmodern. We're not quite there, and it's not deconstruction. It's empowering the reader. Empowering the reader. There's a lot of theories. The most radical of them say there's no author. There's only what's there and the reader left at the end. Okay, the virtual author is what they say. But this is saying to the reader, you are empowered. Is ultimately the statement vapor of vapors, is it vapor of vapors?
It's existential. You've got to make your own definition.
That's why the person claimed it was the source of all existentialism.
It went from nihilism to existentialism. Mm-hmm. We didn't get there till the 20th century.
Okay, I'm not going to...
Sorry.
No. On the contrary. No, I love it. I really do. I don't want to engage it because that's exactly where the book is supposed to leave you. And somebody else in the room might disagree with you. But I remember Elliot Dorf and I had this back and forth about the word existentialism. That was great. That's exactly where the book is supposed to leave us in this. Elliot is a professor of, I forget what he's really a professor of, but he's at the American Jewish University and deals in Jewish thought, among other things. I think book he changes. He becomes more human, more caring, more teaching. And we engage this character, and we engage a character who's given up and who's willing to pass along and tell you, confront me, the I. Because it's a narrative, there's structure. Nobody agrees in structure on Kohelet. And believe me, I've read everyone. There's one Frenchman about 20 years ago who came up with a pattern which I found afterwards, and it was very similar to the one I found. The reason people don't agree on the structure of Kohelet is very simple. They were looking for a philosophy. And a structure of a philosophy is A leads to B, or A plus B is C, or this. So it's very nice and organized, you know. If it's a novella or a short story, then it becomes much more fluid. And a structure can be read because when you have a literary work, They're clues to structure. They're words. We all know that from Psalms and all sorts of other pieces of literature, cue words. The six middle sections of the middle section altogether all begin with a ra'ah in the beginning, the experience, and all begin to end with, so take joy at the end. That's a structure. There's some repetitions, there's some competitions, there's contradictions. That's all fine and dandy. But it works, and there's a structure, and once you read the structure, it's easier to read, and you feel more comfortable with the book and less comfortable with the book because you're always judging and deciding. That's it. And let me give you the zip of all this. The debate for all these years of commentators on Kohelet, so many of them, was, well, this guy at the beginning, the narrator, beginning and end, was that written by the same person who wrote the middle section? Because after all, the narrator at the end sort of takes Kohelet to task, said, a little less books, just observe the mitzvahs, stop thinking so much. Well, first of all, they weren't thinking, and the people who said that back then had not got the models of these eight or nine pieces of literature and antiquity. By the way, it goes through to Shakespeare. There's one of Shakespeare's plays that also has a narrator story, and the narrator comes on the end totally out of the blue. But even more than that, exactly what happens in Kohelet is what happens by adding the narrator. You have the different voices of Kohelet by the poet, the young man, the middle-aged man, the old man, the teacher, the sympathetic, the observer. You have all these voices conflicting and pulling at each other at his life as he's trying to get to some verification of the truths that he's received, not only from Judaism, by the way, from his Jewish tradition, from the wisdom tradition, and the street. Like, wealth should make you happy. Slaves should make you happy. Right? Joy. He's looking for all truths, verification of something under the sun in this world that we can judge.
I digressed. The
narrator. The narrator is simply one more step in the same process of different voices, close enough to appreciate one another, and yet different enough to make you think. That's the whole essence. And if you want something just by fun, I give you a full list and reference in here, but I'll just tell you. What does Kohelet do to the Bible in his radical rereading? He takes phrases from the Bible, and he reinterprets them in light of his failed effort to find truth. And so when he says, fear God, he doesn't mean awe. He means being scared. The Bible means awe. Kohelet means being scared of an arbitrary God. And it goes on and on. He does this with phrases such as good, which for Kohelet means utilitarian. For the Bible was an ethical category. fulfilling vows, better not to vow, every man failing, better obedience than sacrifice. All these have parallels in the Bible. You put it into Kohelet, it becomes much, much heavier. He takes the same phrase and he twists it in a way that just hurts. What does the narrator do? He takes the phrases of Kohelet and he twists them back again. It's astounding. He takes the phrases, and included in these phrases are fear God, which he brings back to awe, as if you've heard. Command, everything, judgment, God will judge, and good. All these things return to traditional Jewish categories. And it is the same author, this brilliant author, who has written the two characters to challenge you with voices and make a judgment. He's seeking truth, he cannot find a verification of truth. What's the bottom line for three people? It's brilliant. I can't begin to tell you how much I appreciate this book. Kohelet ends by saying, I've told you what the truth is, find a little joy. I've got selected pieces of advice. Be happy when you can. That's it. Do what I told you. The narrator says, enough thinking, enough books. Obey God's commandment. That's what he'll judge you in the end. Both of them say, okay, you can stop thinking now. And the author of Ecclesiastes manages at the same time to force you to keep thinking for the rest of your life. Same question. That is astounding. Yeah, in a little way, it's like Job. Anybody who thinks you come out of Job because saying, ah, there's an answer. Job got it out of the window. That's the end of Job. Never read the book of Job. It's the questions that stay with you. And the book of Kohelet leaves you with these challenges and questions of a narrative in ways that are beyond belief. Let me, there are other things that are in the book, obviously. I hope to explain. I'll explain at length in the book why I use vapor. I will explain why I do not use the words ambivalence, pessimism, or absurdity, which one finds in other commentaries. If anyone asks, I'll be happy to. There are other things that are in the book. But what happened to me when writing the book forced me into one further step in writing a commentary different than anything I'd done before. I've only written three of them. I haven't spent my life on writing biblical commentaries. And that was to append to the commentary three pieces of prose, five poems, and 20 questions. The prose and the poetry are all pieces of literature, all written, I think, uniformly, not in English. I wanted to make them available to the English audience, of people who admire Kohelet and disagree with him in one way or another. Because that's what Kohelet wanted. That is what the author of Ecclesiastes wanted. Right?
I gotta read you one. All right?
Digression, I'll get back to the pieces of literature because I mentioned this piece of literature. I promise. I digress, but you'll catch it. The first piece of prose literature that I include in there, if that's all I did, it would have been worth it for me to write the book. I tell you, it's two pages. It's an excerpt from the interpretation of Ecclesiastes by Yosef Tzvi Karlbach, who was killed in the Holocaust. The book was published in the early 40s, and he writes in his introduction to Kohelet an appreciation. He thinks it's the greatest book ever written, and if you ever want to be torn to pieces, he talks about whenever he is low, he reads Kohelet because he realizes that he's not alone in this world. Mm-hmm. It is the most striking little piece of literature. For that alone, I feel so good. If that gets quoted in English, that's worth it for me to have done. That said, there are... Maybe I have a little quote. Let me just read. I'll just read you a little bit of this thing. What the heck? Okay. Death arrives. This is part of his introduction. The greatest guide to life. It's specifically death that teaches us how valuable is every small moment in which we can do something good. Act today, that is the way. Seize the hour, for it will not return. Fill the immediate present hour with happiness. That's out of Kohelet. Before it disappears to never return. Before the plagues of old age and death fall upon you and stop you from acting. From the depths of seriousness, death grants the soul its freedom. And it rises and soars above all the skepticism of human existence. And death gives the soul the wings to ascend to the way of God and his commandments. Guy is writing in 1940s. All right. But let me, in terms of disagreeing with Kohelet, here's a part of Fichman, who wrote a poem about Kohelet speaking. Just four first lines. of many evils, worse is to be foolish. Of virtues, best of all is to be wise. That's all Kohelet. One wisdom did I miss, though, being mulish, to love without a wherefore and a why. The suggestion that if he had looked for love instead of pursuing truth, he would have found truth. Each piece of literature here and each of the questions, I hope, I was just at the Rabbinical Assembly Convention and I said this to several people, you don't have to plan your course on Kohelet if you're in, let them read the commentary first, that's done. The questions of each one were 45 minutes of just assign two people to start debate. And all right. Leah Goldberg's in here and Amichai is in here. Among the 20 questions that I think are just rise from the text. I didn't put anything. I know. Do you ever put questions in the end of your books? Yes?
Occasionally.
It's a new thing. I discovered it in books that I read for book clubs, you know, something, whatever it is. So, and all of a sudden I realized that's what Kohelet is demanding of me as an interpreter, not to make up questions of when did Jack say so and so, but to ask questions which come. I just chose a couple. It would seem that he has no children. Not sure. He's always concerned that he doesn't know who's going to inherit him and what the person's like. Could be that he just doesn't think he knows his kids, but it would seem he has no children. Would he have written the book the same way had he had children? It would have been shorter was the answer, or it would have been worse. He would have been more depressed. I don't care what the answer is. It's, or the love thing comes out. If he was married at one point, he's evidently not married when he writes the book. He had bad experience of some sort. And that comes from that poem. If he had found love, if he had looked for love, if he was free for love, would the answer... Somebody said, I think it's unfair. I really think it's unfair, but I'll quote it. Somebody said, had he spent more time doing things for other people rather than observing, he would have found meaning in life. Now, that's not fair. One of the things, again, I return to my greatest teacher. Moshe Greenberg always told me, you can never make anything of what's not said in a text. It's not relevant. There's a thousand reasons why it's not there. Doesn't mean it wasn't there. So I don't know that he didn't do that, but it's not in the text in any case. Other. Here's a question. Again, from the thing. Could a woman have written Kohelet? I get very interesting answers. It was very interesting at the Rabbinic Assembly Convention. I won't tell you the gender differentiation on the answers I got. Jewish tradition is that Solomon wrote this as an old man. Okay? Could a young man have written Kohelet? Now I won't tell you who, but there's a couple here in which one was saying yes and the other was saying no. Which is exactly, that's what Kohelet, that's what the author of Ecclesiastes wanted us to do. This is literature of the highest type. It is challenging the reader and bringing the reader. How can you admire someone and disagree with them at the same time? Disagree enough to express it and yet admire it enough to say, read it. We have two examples in the book. One is the narrator. Who says, read this guy, and then says, but don't do anything he says. Then in one of the quotes I bring, if I can pronounce your name, I never get it right, Szymborska, the Polish poet who won the Nobel Literature Prize in the late 90s. She gave her speech, and a lot of it was about Kohelet, it was about Ecclesiastes. She didn't differentiate the author, etc. And she said, greatest author, greatest poet, is it in poem? Ever existed, right, he says. She said, but I want to meet him. I'm dying to meet him and walk up to him and said, what do you mean there's nothing new under the sea? Before your book was written, what did it exist under the sun? And now that you're done, you're not working, you're not thinking on the next thing that you're writing under the sun. It's this again, now, the whole concept of the author of this book that put these two people together is a fascinating bit of contemplation of Jewish tradition, which demands of us questioning all the time. I think this is right in the Jewish tradition. Right in the Jewish tradition. Can I be midrashic? I'm in seminar. I can do that. What do we do this week? Erev Mishpatim Asher Tasim Lifneihem. Tasim Lifneihem does not give you. It's offer. It's suggest. Biblical Tasim Lifneihem is what you do with a meal. It's put you in front of you. Zot HaTorah Asher Sam Moshe, and this isn't the Torah that God gave the Jewish people. Offered the Jewish people. There's an offering. Offering requires judgment. Offering requires thinking. Offering requires questioning. What I want, what I don't want, or what I didn't want. This book is 1,000 years later into this Jewish tradition, an ultimate development of a brilliant, questioning, disagreeing kind of Judaism that always offers you more than one perspective. I'm sitting here with one of my teachers, and I remember sitting along with you, and I know two other people who made me all be quiet because I was sitting at some hotel in Jerusalem, and you were talking about the Mishnah. I said, the greatest Jewish piece of literature ever. Three people appear side by side with different points of view, and nobody tries to tell them which is right. Constantly. That stayed with me. Unbelievable. Kohelet is part of the tremendous tradition of question answering.
Look, I hope I've made other contributions in this commentary. In the structure, I hope it's more easy to read. I also hope, and this was the most difficult thing, because it's not an academic book in terms of adhering to the rules of academia. Every half sentence has to have three footnotes as to whoever said that and why you disagreed with some doctoral student in Norway or something like that. I don't write like that, not because it's not necessary, but because I don't. And what I tried to make clear through what footnotes I could put in is that 95% of anything I say comes from the work of great scholars, really great Bible scholars, who spend their days on every little footnote and every little source, etc. But as to, by way of summary, it's not a book of philosophy. It's a narrative that's meant to leave us with eternal questions. I'll give you one more question from the back, because I got to give my son credit.
My son, we were discussing once, why are we reading this on Sukkot, which Svarnim don't do. Basically, it's an Ashkenazic thing that probably by accident, but we were looking for a philosophy for why we do it. And he says, because it was a challenge to Sukkot, and Sukkot's a challenge to it. Mm-hmm. He says, Sukkot tells you in every bit of its fiber that meaning comes through that which is not permanent. And this guy is looking for truth in that which is permanent. It's like, it's a counterweight, he says, to Sukkot, which is this incredible piece of dialogue. I just thought I'd throw that in. It's one of the questions. So
he's very smart, my son. He's an excellent teacher. I would simply paraphrase Heschel when he said this, was talking about something totally different. So I'm using his phrase for something he didn't use, but I'm using his phraseology, so give him credit where it is. I would say that Ecclesiastes is not an answer to all our challenges. It's a challenge to all our answers. That's what the book's about. It's a challenge to all our answers. To have that in the Bible, you know, Christian commentators, some of them, have a great deal of difficulty. Not a great deal of difficulty, but they step back from, because there are no answers. They're questions.
Longman has this wonderful little quote. He said, more or less, it's a wonderful book for its time, the answer to all of Ecclesiastes' questions come in Jesus. Now, it was written before Jesus. It's not a fault. Now, I'm not faulting his theology. But he doesn't understand the book wasn't looking for answers. The book was looking for questions. That's exactly what the book is about. What an incredible part of our tradition that we should have a book so postmodern. Best of all, we're the age that can appreciate Ecclesiastes. That's the point. We're an age of literature. We're an age a bit postmodern in which the reader is empowered. There was a brief time in Jewish history, and we're going back now to when this was written. It was a time of incredibly good writing in Israel, whether that be Esther with its broad satires, Lamentations, Psalms, Song of Songs, Ruth. It's a burst of creativity that exhibited itself as literature as we now understand the term. And then Jewish writing went elsewhere. Nothing wrong with it. Nothing wrong with Talmud. There's nothing wrong with Midrash. There's nothing wrong with the law codes. There's nothing wrong with the tales, the poetry. Nothing wrong with any of this stuff. But as we understand it, we probably didn't return to this kind of literature in a big way, some sparks of it in medieval Spain, until the Enlightenment and beyond. Narratives, tales, poems of search, contemplation. It took us 2,000 years. We are the readers of modernity. And what I tried to do in writing this commentary was bring out how much this book fits that category of something that we want to read, and frankly, that you want to read once a year. It really does work. It really does work, because every time you think you have the answers again, it's worth it to go back and come out with the questions all over again, putting you back into the cycle, which I believe is the most authentic in Jewish tradition. We have 2 or 3 minutes if there's a question. Yes, there's a question.
Yeah. So if I understand you correctly, you're saying that this needs to be read as a story, a narrative, a novella about a character who goes on a journey to search for understanding the human condition and life, and this is what he sees and he comes to know and where he gets to. And now you should understand that you have to go embark on your own journey. This is kind of how a journey looks. So I like that very much, except that only works if when you read a novel, only works if you know you're reading a novel.
Yeah.
And you don't. You're saying 2,000 years later, we're finally figuring out that.
Okay. No, it's a great question. First of all, I want to give a little twist on your summary. He wasn't looking for whatever you said he was.
The human condition.
He was looking for a verification of truth. He inherited truths from Judaism, from wisdom, and from the street. So he wasn't like the Greeks, starting with zero and coming up with it. So that's a little bit different. I don't know what to do with that, and it's a hard problem for me. I had more of a problem with that. Or let me do it. Maybe it's easier to understand the other way. I can say that. I don't feel bad about saying that. When I did my work on Song of Songs, which was a lifelong passion until I was able to put it down, I came to the conclusion that the Song of Songs was a love poem, a human love poem, probably reflecting the Jewish love ethos, possibly written by a woman. I wasn't the only person to say that. And a single piece of literature that holds together in a certain very clear way. It could have been said to me, and a couple of people have said to me, oh yeah, thank you, after 2,000 years, you've come along and figured out something. And I had to step back to them and say, I didn't come to it. I'm not that smart. I'm really not. But I'm born into a certain age. And we have certain new ways of reading that, and Judaism has always done that, to apply the hermeneutics of their time to what's going on in their literature. And while an allegory may have befitted Song of Songs for a while, and attribution to pagan literature, or later, in the 19th century into the 20th, calling it a Greek play, may have fit those times, they didn't get it. Mm-hmm. Now, I wasn't just like here. I didn't do this all myself. There were other people who said it was a single book by then. They hadn't quite gotten the picture all together. I had 30 references. But it's okay to say that after 30 years, modernity has allowed us to see things that we were less sensitive before. We haven't really dealt, apart from, there is some great stuff in the Golden Age of Spain. I shouldn't have downplayed it so much, but it didn't flow on. But we really haven't dealt with modern kinds of literature and Jewish literature for 2,000 years. And to say now that we're seeing it, we can see that there was this age. That's why I cited these other books. I think Esther was misread. It's a broad parody on everybody, making fun of the Jews, making fun of the diaspora, making fun of the Greeks. They're making fun of everybody. That's a real book. Ruth is incredibly. I've read a whole bunch of literature. I haven't written any of it, right? On the feminism of Ruth. Very complex. The differences between George Savern in Israel wrote a wonderful article recently. The differences between Naomi and Ruth in their feminism and their feminine bonding. The fact that no one saw it before, does that mean it's not there? That wasn't in the original? He convinces me it is in the original. So it's not quite so damning to say, how come somebody didn't do that 200 years ago? New times allow us to see things and allow us to say, hey, we were way ahead of time. We didn't see women in the Tanakh for thousands of years. Yeah.
I think it's interesting that you quoted the Hamlet speech when you're talking about the different Weltschmerzes, you know? And the Hamlet had a solution that was not available to Cohen. And he took it.
Okay.
The solution he had is he was afraid of what he would find in the afterworld. He believed in that afterworld. He said, but, you know, if something after death. And that wasn't available to Kohelet, to use that as a solution.
Kohelet, the character, very clearly, that's very clear about it, comes to his conclusion that he has no verification of the truths that he finds, that he got under the sun. Under the sun is a tricky phrase. The Bible knows of a world above the sun. Does it mean next world? Some would say, I don't think so. Does it mean that we don't know everything and human beings are limited? I think so. I think that's more insane. But Kohelet comes to an unhappy, I said he was very unhappy because he was seeking truth and didn't find it.
But
did not have solutions.
Had an answer.
Okay, I didn't mean to say Hamlet was Kohelet. I was just using literature to show how effective it is.
To be or not to be.
Yeah.
No, I didn't. I misled you. I misled you. All I meant to say is that literature gains its power from the moment and the speaker. Not, I should have used another year, thank you. I will never use that again. Literature gains its power from the moment and the speaker and the human being that's there, not a philosophy. It's not a philosophical question, it's a human question. That's all I wanted to say, and I understand, I misled you. Yes.
It's a beautiful read of Kohelet. I think you minimize the Greek influence.
Okay.
Kohelet's conception of time is cyclical, and that's a Greek conception. It's not a biblical conception.
It may be. I don't disagree with that. We could have also noted that the four base elements commonly attributed to Greek literature are there in that first four, earth, water, whatever they are, fire and what did I do? They're there. There is a Greek and it was on foot. Culture around. It doesn't seem to be reflected in Kohelet linguistically. There's no hint of Greek. It's one of the reasons people are sure that it's written in Israel and not in Egypt where they spoke Greek. They spoke Hebrew or an Aramaic in Israel, they didn't speak Greek. I don't discount any of that. It's just when I said All I want to say is that most of the writers, and the overwhelming majorities, cannot pigeonhole Kohelet within one of these things. There was exchange. It's much more complicated, even than what you say. There's one section of Kohelet that they have now, they, not I, Bible scholars have now found in one version of Gilgamesh 1,200 years ahead of time, before his time, almost verbatim. So the exchange, you go nuts. Where did this all come from, and where were the currents flowing? I think we'd be foolish not to say there was exchange. We'd be foolish not to say that Kohelet was not a part of this culture, of the stress on the eye, of the thinking on the, I'm going to get to the truth. But there are these differences. He was not happy. He was not looking for truth on its own sake. He was looking for verification of the truths that he received, and he didn't find them. And what he did was, how do I get along in life without that? And that's what he was looking for. He wasn't looking for the truth that will set me free, which I think is a little different than the Greek schools of thought. One more.
There are, as you can see, copies of the volume available for purchase, $15 either in cash or pay to the order of the author. I just want to draw your attention to the fact that a week from Monday, March 13th, at the same time, probably in the same room, Professor Benji Gampel will be speaking about his new book, Anti-Jewish Riots in the Crown of Aragon and the Royal Response, winner of National Jewish Book Award for scholarship, so it should be a very interesting presentation, and we invite you to return then. Thank you.
Thank you very much.